Hello, it's Angel. Let's continue Love in the Night. This is part two by F. Scott Fitzgerald. It was dark in Cannes Harbor, rather it seemed dark after the brightness of the promenade that Val had just left. Three frail dock lights glittered dimly upon innumerable fishing boats heaped like shells along the beach. Farther out in the water, there were other lights where a fleet of slender yachts rode the tide with slow dignity, and farther still a full ripe moon made the water bosom into a polished dancing floor. Occasionally, there was a swish, a creak, a drip, as a rowboat moved about in the shallows, and its blurred shape threaded the labyrinth of hobbled fishing skiffs and launches. Val descended the velvet slope of sand, stumbled over a sleeping boatman, and caught the rank savor of garlic and plain wine. Taking the man by the shoulders, he shook open his startled eyes. "Do you know where the Minnehaha is anchored, and the privateer?" As they slid out into the bay, he lay back in the stern and stared with vague discontent at the Riviera moon. That was the right moon. All right. Frequently, 5 nights out of 7, there was the right moon. And here was the soft air, aching with enchantment. And here was the music, many strains of music from many orchestras, drifting out from the shore. Eastward lay the dark cape, and beyond that, Monte Carlo, where the night rang, chinking full of gold. Someday, he would enjoy all that, too. Know its every pleasure and success, when he was too old and wise to care. But tonight, that stream of silver that waved like a wide strand of curly hair towards the moon, those soft romantic lights of Cannes behind him, the irresistible love in this air, that was to be wasted forever. "Which one?" asked the boatman suddenly. "Which one?" demanded Val, sitting up. "Which boat?" He pointed. Val turned above, hovered the gray, sword-like prow of the yacht. During the sustained longing of his wish, they had covered half a mile. He read the brass letters over his head. It was the privateer, but there were only dim lights on board, and no music and no voices, only a murmurous K-plash of intervals at the small waves leaped at the side. "The other one," said Val, "the Minnehaha." "Don't go yet." Val started. The voice, low and soft, had dropped down from the darkness overhead. "What's the hurry?" said the soft voice. "Thought maybe someone was coming to see me, and had suffered terrible disappointment." The boatman lifted his oars and looked hesitantly at Val, but Val was silent, so the man let the blades fall into the water and swept the boat out into the moonlight. "Wait a minute," cried Val sharply. "Goodbye," said the voice. "Come again, when you can stay longer." "But I'm going to stay now," he answered. He gave the necessary order, and the rowboat swung back to the foot of the small companionway. Someone young, someone in a misty white dress, someone with a lovely low voice, had actually called to him out of the velvet dark. "If she has eyes," Val murmured to himself. He liked that romantic sound of it, and repeated it under his breath. "If she has eyes." "What are you?" She was directly above him now. She was looking down, and he was looking up. As he climbed the ladder and their eyes met, they both began to laugh. She was very young, slim, almost frail, with the dress that accentuated her youth by its blanched simplicity. Two wan dark spots on her cheeks marked where the color was by day. "What are you?" she repeated, moving back and laughing again as his head appeared on the level of the deck. "I'm frightened now, and I want to know." "I am a gentleman," said Val, bowing. "What sort of gentleman?" "There are all sorts of gentlemen. There was a colored gentleman at the table next to ours in Paris, and so..." She broke off. "You're not American, are you?" "I'm Russian," he said, as he might have announced himself to an archangel. He thought quickly and then added, "And I am the most fortunate of Russians. All this day, all this spring, I have dreamed of falling in love on such a night, and now I see that heaven has sent me to you. Just one moment, she said with a little gasp. I'm sure now that this visit is a mistake. I don't go into anything like that, please. I beg your pardon? He looked at her in bewilderment, unaware that he had taken too much for granted, that he drew himself up formally. I've made an error. If you will excuse me, I will say good night. He turned away, his hand on the rail. Don't go, she said, pushing a strand of indefinite hair out of her eyes. On second thoughts, you can talk any nonsense you like if you only not go. I'm miserable, and I don't want to be left alone. Val hesitated. There was some element in this that he failed to understand. He had taken it for granted that a girl who called to a strange man at night, even from the deck of a yacht, was certainly in the mood for romance, and he wanted intensely to stay. Then he remembered that this was one of the two yachts he had been seeking. I imagine that the dinner's on the other boat, he said. The dinner? Oh, yes, it's on the Minnehaha. Were you going there? I was going there. A long time ago. What's your name? He was on the point of telling her when something made him ask a question instead. And you? Why are you not at the party? Because I preferred to stay here. Mrs. Jackson said there would be some rushes there. I suppose that's you. She looked at him with interest. You're a very young man, aren't you? I'm much older than I look, said Val swiftly. People always comment on it. It's considered rather a remarkable thing. How old are you? 21, he lied. She laughed. What nonsense. You're not more than 19. His annoyance was so perceptible that she hastened to reassure him. Cheer up, I'm only 17 myself. I might have gone to the party if I had thought there'd be anyone under 50 there. He welcomed the change of subject. You preferred to sit and dream here beneath the moon? I've been thinking of mistakes. They sat down side by side in two canvas deck chairs. It's a most engrossing subject, the subject of mistakes. Women very seldom brood about mistakes. They're much more willing to forget than men are. But when they do brood... You have made a mistake? Inquired Val. She nodded. Is it something that cannot be repaired? I think so, she said. I can't be sure. That's what I'm considering when you came along. Perhaps I can help in some way, said Val. Perhaps your mistake is not irreparable after all. You can't, she said unhappily. So let's not think about it. I'm very tired of my mistake, and I'd much rather you'd tell me about all the gay, cheerful things that are going on in Cannes tonight. They glanced shoreward at the line of mysterious and alluring lights, the big toy banks with candles inside that were really the great fashionable hotels, the lighted clock in the old town, the blurred glow of the cafe, the pricked out points of villa windows rising on slow hills toward the dark sky. What is everyone doing there? She whispered. It looks as though something gorgeous was going on, but what it is I can't quite tell. Everyone there is making love, said Val quietly. Is that it? She looked for a long time with a strange expression in her eyes. Then I want to go home to America, she said. There's too much love here. I want to go home tomorrow. You're afraid of being in love, then? She shook her head. It isn't that. It's just because there is no love here for me. Or for me either, added Val quietly. It is sad that we two should be at such a lovely place on such a lovely night and have nothing. He was leaning toward her intently with a sort of inspired and chaste romance in his eyes, and she drew back. Tell me more about yourself, she inquired quickly. If you are Russian, where did you learn to speak such excellent English? My mother is American, he admitted. My grandfather was American also, so she had no choice in the matter. Then you're American too. I am Russian, said Val with dignity. She looked at him closely, smiled, and decided not to argue. Well then, she said diplomatically. I suppose you must have a Russian name. But he had no intention now of telling her his name. A name even the Rostov name would be a discretion of the a des sorry a desecration of the night. They were their own low voices, their two white faces, and that was enough, he was sure, without a reason for being sure, but with a sort of instinct that sang triumphantly through his mind, that in a little while, a minute or an hour, he was going to undergo an initiation into the life of romance. His name had no reality beside what was stirring in his heart. "You're beautiful," he said suddenly. "How do you know?" "Because a woman, for women, moonlight is the hardest light of all." "Am I nice in the moonlight?" "You are the loveliest thing I have ever known." "Oh," she thought this over. "Of course I have no business to let you come on board. I might have known what we'd talk about in this moon. But I can't sit here and look at the shore forever. I'm too young for that. Don't you think I'm too young for that?" "Much too young," he said solemnly. Suddenly, they both became aware of the new music that was close at hand. Music that seemed to come out of the water not 100 yards away. "Listen," she cried. "It's from the Minnehaha. They've finished dinner." For a moment, they listened in silence. "Thank you," said Val suddenly. "For what?" He hardly knew he had spoken. He was thanking the deep, low horns of the singing in the breeze. The sea for its warm, murmurous complaint against the bow, the milk of the stars for washing over them until he felt buoyed up in a substance more taut than air. "So lovely," she whispered. "What are we going to do about it?" "Do you have to do something about it? I thought we could just sit and enjoy." "You didn't think that," he interrupted quietly. "You know that we must do something about it. I am going to make love to you, and you are going to be glad." "I can't," she said very low. She wanted to laugh now, to make some light, cool remark that would bring the situation back into safe waters of a casual flirtation, but it was too late now. Val knew that the music had completed what the moon had begun. "I will tell you the truth," he said. "You are my first love. I am 17, the same age as you, no more." There was something utterly disarming about the fact that they were the same age. It made her helpless before the fate that had thrown them together. The deck chairs creaked, and he was conscious of a faint, elusive perfume as they swayed suddenly and childishly together.